Glenn mentioned at one point in the service, he said something like, you know, they'll come along and they'll see that you're normal people, or at least they'll see that at first. And it made me think of something I saw this week. I've got an app on my phone called Time Hop. Some of you know what that is. It tells you what you posted on social media, Twitter or Facebook, either a year ago or 2 years ago and 3 years ago. And 2 years ago, on a Sunday, I posted that, I said, someone said to me today, the thing about you people, it was someone who was brand new to church, the thing that I love about you people at Hillview is you're really normal and yet really not normal. That made me smile. I thought, well, that's probably what we should be shooting for. We should be shooting to be in the world, but not of the world. And I pray that the Lord would help us to more and more be really normal, but really not normal. And maybe even this morning, I think he's been at work to that end. Violence is shocking. Despite the many, most likely correct claims that because of television shows or movies or computer games, despite the claims that because of these things, we're becoming increasingly desensitized to violence, I think that's probably true. To an extent, at least, the reality is still that when we see an act of unprovoked violence, it startles us at best, or at worst, can leave us deeply shaken and likely speechless. And we see this in a few different scenarios. If you think back to some images of what this might look like in a fairly trivial sense. So think, for example, of the politician walking down the street on the campaign trail and someone runs out from the crowd and tries to attack them. And the sense of shock that you have in that moment when someone throws something or throws a punch, it shocks us. It leaves us startled. Or even something as very trivial as when a footballer loses his cool completely on the football field. And not so long ago, they were commenting on the radio at the end of January that it was 20 years since Eric Cantona ran into the crowd at Crystal Palace and launched his kung fu kick at one of the supporters of Crystal Palace. And I remember when I first saw that footage, and I remember being devastated that it was 20 years ago when I heard that. But I remember when I first saw that footage and the utter shock and disbelief of this man running and flying and kicking one of the supporters of Crystal Palace. No one could quite believe it. And it shocks us. Now, it's one thing when we see a mass brawl or a riot or something like that. There's almost too much going on there for us to fully understand or comprehend. But when we see violence aimed particularly and focused at one individual, it's very, very difficult to stomach, especially if that individual at whom the violence is concentrated and the hatred is aimed, especially if that person is someone who's innocent. That's the reason why films like Schindler's List are so hard to watch, because when we see the ugliness of pain and shame heaped upon someone who doesn't deserve it for prolonged periods in horrible ways, it's almost too much for us to take. It can turn our stomach. It can make us want to turn our face away. It can make us wish that it would stop. It's not a nice feeling. And the words of today's passage in Luke should make us feel like that. Chapter 22, verse 63. Now the men who were holding Jesus in custody were mocking him as they beat him. They also blindfolded him and kept asking him, "Prophesy! Who is it that struck you?" And they said many other things against him, blaspheming him. We need to consider, how will we respond as we hear these words today? And as for the coming few weeks, we journey through Luke chapter 23. And as we approach Good Friday, we think about, what does it mean that Jesus died on the cross? What's that all about? How should we react to these words? Well, let's read the rest of the passage. Carrying on from verse 66 of Luke chapter 22. When day came, the assembly of the elders of the people gathered together, both chief priests and scribes, and they led him away to their council. And they said, "If you are the Christ, tell us." But he said to them, "If I tell you, you will not believe. And if I ask you, you will not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of the power of God." So they all said, "Are you the Son of God then?" And he said to them, "You say that I am." Then they said, "What further testimony do we need? We have heard it ourselves from his own lips." Then the whole company of them arose and brought him before Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this man misleading our nation and forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, a king." And Pilate asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And he answered him, "You have said so." Then Pilate said to the chief priests and the crowds, "I find no guilt in this man." But they were urgent, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, from Galilee even to this place." When Pilate heard this, he asked whether the man was a Galilean. When he learned that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him over to Herod, who was himself in Jerusalem at that time. When Herod saw Jesus, he was very glad, for he had long desired to see him, because he had heard about him, and he was hoping to see some sign done by him. So he questioned him at some length, but he made no answer. The chief priests and the scribes stood by, vehemently accusing him, and Herod with his soldiers treated him with contempt and mocked him. Then, arraying him in splendid clothing, he sent him back to Pilate. And Herod and Pilate became friends with each other that very day, for before this they had been at enmity with one another. We've seen lots of glimpses of the religious leaders, and we've seen a real sense of their increasing, over the pages of Luke, their increasing unease at who Jesus was, what he was doing, what he said about himself. But really, this is the first time we've seen the religious and the political leaders truly and fully show their teeth. We've seen glimpses, but nothing like this to this point. And of course, it's going to intensify further. So we are confronted by the question, you know, perhaps especially if you're new to church or new to faith, you're confronted by this question, but we all really, it's worth us all thinking about this. We're confronted by the question, why? Why are they behaving like this? Why was Jesus treated like this? And as we look back over these last couple of years that we've had in Luke, the question that comes to mind is, as we consider the Jesus that we've been reading about, was that Jesus deserving of this? That Jesus born to a humble family from unexceptionable Nazareth, was he deserving of that? That Jesus who was laid in a feeding trough directly following his birth, was that Jesus deserving of this? Begin to think back over Jesus' words and actions that we've been considering in Luke over these last couple of years. And I wonder, is there a moment that is particularly precious to you? Is there an image from these chapters that has stuck in your mind? Is there a teaching that has stuck with you? Perhaps it was the announcement that Jesus made right at the very start of his ministry, that he came to preach good news to the poor, to proclaim liberty to those who are in captivity, to open the eyes of the blind, to set free the oppressed, to speak of this new moment in history when God's favor would be poured out and would be available to every man and woman and girl and boy. That was who Jesus said he was when he first came on the scene. Is that Jesus deserving of this? Or perhaps as you think back over these chapters of Luke, maybe you think of one of Jesus' wonderful acts of healing. Do you remember the woman in Luke chapter 8 who had the issue of bleeding, who'd been bleeding for 12 years and because of that had been held at arm's length, not allowed to be part of her community, seen as an outcast, seen as dirty, seen as disgusting for 12 years. And she sneaked up to Jesus and all she wanted to do was touch his cloak. And she did that. And as she just touched his cloak, her bleeding stopped. But it didn't stop there, Jesus' encounter with this woman, because though her bleeding had stopped, Jesus didn't want her to leave in fearful obscurity. And do you remember what he did? He called on her. He said, "Who did that?" And she fell before him in fear and trembling. And Jesus wanted her to be fully restored to the community in that moment. Do you remember what he said to her? He wanted everyone to see him call her daughter. Daughter. And do you remember what Jesus did? He spoke his peace over this woman. What a beautiful picture of restoration and healing in its fullest sense. Maybe that's an image that stays with you. Or perhaps it was when Jesus showed himself to be the God who stops. Do you remember when Jesus is passing through Jericho and the blind beggar cries out for mercy and Jesus stops? And listens. And though the crowd rebuked him and tried to silence him, Jesus just asked him, just said, "What is it you want? What would you like me to do for you?" And the man said, "I just want to see." And Jesus immediately made it so. Maybe that's the picture that stays with you. Or maybe it was the touching of those who were untouchable, or the raising of life. The raising to life of the dead, or the setting of peace, those who are plagued by demons. Perhaps when you think back over Luke and you think of this Jesus, you think of one of those wonderful acts of healing. Or maybe it's part of Jesus' teaching that comes to mind. It's one of the stories that he told, or the lessons that he taught us that first comes to mind. Do you remember when Jesus said what the kingdom of heaven was like? Do you remember he said it was like a great feast? And it was a great feast for those who couldn't afford to be at the feast. And it was for those who didn't think that they would be invited. And it was for those who he had sent people to seek out and to bring from the far and distant lands and to put before them this beautiful, bountiful feast. And Jesus says, the kingdom of heaven is like that. It's for people who know they don't deserve it. It's blessing beyond words. That's an awesome teaching that Jesus had to share. Or maybe it was when Jesus taught us what God the Father was like. And he said, do you know that God your Father is someone who will never, ever give up on you? Even though you push him away, even though you go your own way, even though you ignore him, God's going to stay there. He's going to wait for you. That's what God your Father is like. Do you remember how Jesus said, you know what? You fathers who are just normal fathers, you know how you love to give good gifts to your children? Well, if that's true, how much more will your Father in heaven give good gifts to those who love him, even the Holy Spirit, God himself? She said, you have no idea the goodness of your Father in heaven. You remember Jesus taught that? What a wonderful thing to teach. Perhaps you recall how Jesus said, and we've been thinking about this morning. Do you remember he said, blessed are you who weep now, for you shall laugh. That's stunning. Not just blessed are you who weep now, for you shall endure. For you'll get through. For you'll make it. You'll smile, you'll know no pain, but blessed are you who weep this morning. One day you're going to laugh, you're going to jump, you're going to rejoice. Do you remember when Jesus said that? Do you remember when Jesus said, don't be anxious? Do you know how much my Father in heaven values you? Wow, maybe it's one of these moments that sticks with you. Or perhaps finally, the main image from Luke that has stuck with you is one of the reactions of those whose lives were changed by Jesus in this way. Do you remember Elizabeth's pre-born son leaping in her womb when he came into the near presence of the not yet born King of Kings, Jesus? Do you remember Peter falling at Jesus' feet and then just deciding to leave his business behind, his home behind, to follow after Jesus because Jesus just said, come and follow me. Come and follow me. Do you remember the woman in Luke chapter 7, known only as the woman of the city, a sinner? Do you remember how she came and she fell at Jesus' feet, weeping, and she cleaned his feet with her tears, and she dried them with her hair, and she poured on Jesus' feet the most precious of ointment, and she kissed his feet and welcomed him in this outpouring of amazement that Jesus would love someone like her? Do you remember that picture? Or so on and so on. We could go on. What is it you think of as you think back over the Gospel of Luke, as you think about his love and his life and his teaching? These have been good months, haven't they? These have been good months thinking about some of these things. And as we reflect over that, as I hope we all are this morning, amazed afresh at the wonder of Jesus' love for us, how are we to make sense of the mockery and the vile hatred and violence that we see in our passage today? The merciless mockery of a bleeding and bound man. The striking in the face and body of this Jesus that we have been thinking of. The bruising of knuckles as clenched fists broke his skin, causing his blood to begin to flow. The cruel and calculated act of finding from somewhere a makeshift blindfold and wrapping over his eyes and continually striking him as they laughed, assuming that he had no idea when or from where the next blow would come. What is the meaning of this? It should turn our stomach. And we need to come and say, what's going on here? What is this all about? How are we to understand this disgusting evil, these vile taunts? How are we to make sense and understand the frenzied and urgent desire of these religious leaders to find whatever means they could to just get Jesus gone? How are we going to make sense of that? Well, Luke is not silent on that question. Luke is not silent on why this happened. The whole gospel isn't silent, and this passage isn't silent. Why was Jesus being treated this way? What was his crime? Luke wants to make clear for us in this passage what his crime was. Jesus' crime was this, that he claimed to be God. He claimed to be God. He claimed to be a king. He claimed to be the king. That he and he alone was the source of ultimate authority. Now, again, we've seen this in glimpses up until this point. In Luke chapter 4, in Jesus' first day of ministry, do you remember what happened? They were amazed at Jesus' teaching in the synagogue when he read from Isaiah 61. And then he said, oh yeah, but just so you know, your understanding of how God is going to bring people into his kingdom is quite different from mine. And actually, we're going to bring the people who are far off. We're not just going to bring the people of Israel. And Jesus began to reinterpret them what religion looked like, what God looked like, what God's relationship to his people looked like. And do you remember what happened? They wanted to throw him off a cliff. That was the first little glimpse of this in Luke chapter 4. And over time, that Jesus made it more and more clear, I have a different message to share with you about how God operates. And I'm going to make clear a few things for you. I'm going to make clear what you can and can't do on the Sabbath. I'm going to make clear that I can forgive sins. I'm going to make clear to you what religious laws need to be kept and so on and so forth, and what God is truly like. And over time they realized the reason that Jesus thinks he can do all this is because he thinks he himself is God. And we can see them in this passage test Jesus on this. In verse 67 of chapter 22, they want Jesus to admit to them that he is the Messiah, the anointed one, the Christ, the one who would rescue God's people. But Jesus raises the stakes much further than that. Look at verse 69 of chapter 22. Jesus says, "From now on, the Son of Man shall be seated at the right hand of the power of God." Now, this is one of the most remarkable claims that Jesus makes about himself in the whole of the Gospel of Luke. And then it goes on in verse 70. "So they all said, 'Are you the Son of God then?' And he said to them, 'You say that I am.'" So you have this picture which Jesus is willingly allowing to be painted, and a number of different names and attributes and titles for God that are being stacked up here. The Christ, the Son of Man, seated at the right hand of God, the place of royalty, in the place of the power of God, the Son of God. It's not unclear in this passage who Jesus is claiming to be. And then a similar charge comes to Pilate. They take Jesus and they take him to Pilate. You see, the Jewish people could do, the Roman authorities had given them freedom to have a certain amount of freedom in their legal system, but they couldn't put someone to death. So if they really wanted to get rid of Jesus, they had to take him to the Roman governor, Pilate. And what's the charge that they bring before Pilate? We see it in verse 2 of chapter 23. "We found this man misleading our nation, forbidding us to give tribute to Caesar, and saying that he himself is Christ, that he's a king." Pilate puts this to Jesus, and Jesus makes no effort to deny it. And then Pilate sends Jesus before Herod. And this time Jesus responds a little differently again. This time he just says nothing. He just stands there. He will not play ball with Herod's wishes. Verse 9 of chapter 23. "So Herod questioned him at some length, but he made no answer." And it's interesting in light of that how this section ends. Look at verse 10. "The chief priests and the scribes," so there's the religious leaders still there, still trying to make their case, "they stood by vehemently accusing him, and Herod with his soldiers treated him with contempt and mocked him." Then, interesting, "arraying him in splendid clothing, he sent him back to Pilate." So, of course they're doing it in mockery, but the picture is clear. Jesus is in perfect control. Jesus is in perfect authority here. He's not cowering in fear before Herod. He's not answering his every beck and call. He's not doing everything that Herod demands of him. He is silent, in control, secure, safe, strong, and then he is clothed as a king, and sent back to his trial. What's the point of all of this? The point is Luke is now making explicit what has been increasingly seen to be the case throughout the chapters of Luke. Jesus understood himself to be God. It's what had increasingly outraged the Jewish leaders, and now they finally have him. They want it on record, and Jesus has no desire in these verses to shy away from that claim. Jesus understood himself to be God. My friends, Jesus is more than just a good teacher. More than just someone who has some good moral life lessons for us to live with. He's much more than that. Jesus is more than just a social revolutionary. Someone who came to show a way to break free from captivity and to give hope and heart to the poor and those enslaved. He is that, but he's much, much more than just that. He was God. He is God. The Bible could not be clearer about that, okay? We just looked at these few verses in Luke, and we've had to dig a little bit for it, but the Bible could not be clearer about the fact that Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus Christ, understood himself, claimed to be God in heaven. And this is wonderful news. Because of this little overview that we just did of Luke. You want to know what God looks like? You want to know who God really is? Then read the Gospel of Luke again this afternoon. You see God in the face of Jesus Christ. We understand what kind of God we're dealing with when we read the pages of the whole Bible indeed. But in particular, as we see Jesus at work, full of grace and compassion and kindness. A God who brings healing and wholeness and hope.
What a God we have. But the question is still there then. Well, if that's such good news, brings us back, why is all this horrible stuff happening? Why is Jesus being beaten and sent off to be killed? What's the problem here? If what God offers is so good, then why is it so bad, what we're reading? Well, in this passage, we see three different violent reactions to Jesus' claim to be God the King. And they're reactions, I think, that we can see in part at least in our own heart, certainly in the lives of many, many people around Aberdeen. And please don't worry, that was not just my introduction. Okay, I'm getting to the first of my 3 points, but they're brief, and we're well more than halfway into the message. Three violent reactions we see to Jesus' claim to be God and King in this passage. First of all, the religious leaders' fury. The religious leaders' fury. Yes, it's true that Jesus offers kindness and compassion and hope and ultimate healing and wholeness. If not in this life, then certainly one day when we see him face to face and every tear will be wiped from our eyes, when Jesus will indeed make all things new, as we were reading earlier on. Yes, that's what Jesus offers us. But here's the thing. Jesus is not some hoop that we need to jump through in order to get these things. It's in him that these things are found. It's in him that kindness and grace and compassion and mercy is found. It's in him that wholeness and healing and ultimate lasting hope is found. Jesus is not an optional add-on. Jesus is not any means to an end. But it's in and through a relationship with God through Jesus Christ that our ultimate hope is. And here's the thing about that. A relationship with God in heaven has many, many seeming downsides to it. There are easier ways to maximize your pleasure here in the years that you have on this earth than following Jesus. Remember what Paul said? If all of this isn't true, if this is a nonsense, we are of all men most to be pitied. Paul said, I die every day because of this gospel. There are easier ways to know a little bit of joy for a little bit of time here on this earth. A relationship with Jesus is one of self-denial. Taking up our cross daily and following him. Why? Because if we want to save our life, then we have to lose it, Jesus said. But there are some seeming difficulties in that. There are some problems with that. Someone who claims that they are God has a right to rule over my life. God has a right to reshape how I think I should live. God has the right to reshape what I think I can do and what I think I can do. Someone who claims to be God simply makes clear that I'm not God. And that's a little bit uncomfortable, if we're honest, because we would quite like to be God. We would quite like to rule the roost. We would quite like to make all our own decisions for our own good. It's not the way. He's God, we're not. And in that is ultimate hope and healing and life and joy. But in day-to-day life, it can be difficult. So we're left with a choice. Come and embrace this God and all the blessings that come with him, or reject him, push him away. And the religious leaders of Jesus' day were crystal clear on what they thought of that offer. You see, Jesus had messed things up for them in two ways. First of all, he had deeply offended their religious beliefs. And secondly, he had threatened their place of privilege. You see, they were convinced that they were in charge, that they had the final say on who God accepted and who he didn't. And my question to you this morning is, do you feel like that ever? Do you feel like that as you consider the lordship of Jesus? Do you feel that he offends your religious beliefs? Do you feel that he threatens your place of privilege? You see, we all have some sort of overarching worldview that determines how we think of what is right and what is wrong. And the question before us this morning is, who is the boss of that worldview? Who's in charge? Who's in charge of your behavior? Who's in charge of your dreams and your hopes and your joys and your bank account and your family and your relationship? Who's in charge? This can be difficult for us. This idea that we have to surrender these things to God is as deeply offensive and disturbing in our culture today as it was to these religious leaders. And they made very clear what they thought of that offer. You have blown it, Jesus. You don't understand what God is all about. And actually, do you know what? We are in charge of who makes that call anyway. So, Jesus, off with you. That's the first reaction. The second reaction we see is Pilate's lazy indifference. They bring Jesus before Pilate, and he says in verse 4 of chapter 23, I find no guilt in this man. The Jewish leaders press him. You know, he says he's a king, you know, Pilate. And then in verse 5 of chapter 23, and oh, by the way, he's stirring up people, teaching them throughout all Judea from Galilee to even to this place. They're trying to get Pilate frightened and scared. This is a man claiming to be a king, stirring up trouble. And Pilate, that doesn't make a good situation for you, a Roman governor. So when Pilate hears that Jesus is a Galilean, he sees his chance to just pass Jesus along. Someone else can deal with this guy. I'd rather it was someone else's problem. Do you ever feel like that when you think about God? Yes, Jesus might be who he says he is, or he might not be who he says he is. All I know is, I don't want to deal with this. I just don't want to go there. This can be someone else's issue. They can sort it out. Even if, you know what, even if they just have to tell me what to do, as long as I don't have to fully engage with this person, Jesus. And like Pilate, we can find whatever apparent loophole there is to just get rid of Jesus, get him away, someone else can deal with it. I'm just indifferent, I'm lazy about this, I just don't want to deal with this. Is that you? Finally, Herod's self-centered fascination with Jesus. Verse 8 of chapter 23. When Herod saw Jesus, he was very glad, for he had long desired to see him, because he'd heard about him. He was hoping to see some sign done by him. Herod thought Jesus was fascinating. He'd heard some amazing things about Jesus, and he wanted to see something for himself. He wanted a trick. He wanted something to widen his eyes at and wonder at and be impressed by. But here's the thing. This was not out of any love or reverence or care for Jesus. It was just to satisfy himself. And we know this because when Jesus doesn't play ball, Herod just sends him off back to his trial. Do you ever feel like that? Do you ever feel like that as you consider Jesus' claims to be God? A certain fascination with Jesus, or with some deity, or with spiritual things, a desire to see something amazing happen, to dip your toes in the spiritual pool around about you, whatever you can find. This is huge in our culture. You get a glimpse of it if you go down to Newton D, the cafe there, and the lovely community that they've got there. And if you stand and you look at the notice board, you see signs for some of these things. Angel parties, good luck charms, tarot card readings, seances, horoscopes, nature worship, transcendental meditation, and so on and so on. Not to mention the many superstitions that folk carry around with them week in, week out. Or perhaps even, it's not just those things, but you are interested in Jesus, but it's just an interest that would meet your needs. It's just something that you want to tick a few boxes, to give you a sense of buzz in your life. Ultimately, it's a self-centered fascination. And if Jesus won't give us what we're looking for, we'll mock him, we'll beat him, and we'll send him away and be done with him. Is that you?
So three reactions in this passage of Jesus to Jesus' claims to be God, all of them resulting in his beating, his mockery, and ultimately, as we're going to see, his death. So as I close now, I want to ask, are you one of those three reactions? Or if not, how will we respond? How will we respond this morning to Jesus' claims to be God? We are in a privileged position, friends. We're not one of the religious leaders. We're not Pilate. We're not Herod. But we gather this morning and we can step back from this story and we can look on. We have had passed down to us over the centuries God's holy, inspired, and perfect scriptures for us, which make clear to us things that these people in this passage were not able to see. We stand and we look on at this scene, and we don't just see a claim to be a king and some unfortunate resulting violence, which is the end of the story, but we know that there's hope, that there is another part to Luke's gospel, that chapter 23 will not be the end, but chapter 24 is the end. We see that Jesus' claims to his divinity and his authority were vindicated by his resurrection. Everything in Christianity hinges on the resurrection of Jesus. It's not ultimately about whether you find Jesus appealing this morning. It's about, did Jesus rise from the dead or not? Because if he did, you better seek after him and pray that you would find that sense of worship and adoration. Did Jesus rise from the dead? We see that Jesus' claim to kingship was vindicated by his resurrection. And we also see that the violence aimed at Jesus is not just some add-on, but is at the very center of what it is that makes Jesus glorious. Do you know that one day we will stand in the presence of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords and the living creatures and the elders and the angels? And do you know that we will sing a new song? Do you know what we will sing? Before the throne and the living creatures and among the elders, I saw a lamb standing as though it had been slain, with seven horns and with seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God sent out into all the earth. And he went and took the scroll from the right hand of him who was seated on the throne. When he had taken the scroll of the four living creatures and the 24 elders, they fell down before the Lamb, each holding a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are the prayers of the saints. And they sang a new song, saying, "Worthy are you to take the scroll and to open its seals. Why? For you were slain." Here's the point of this violence that we've been confronted by. Worthy are you, Jesus, for you were slain, and by your blood you ransomed people, you bought people, you achieved people for God from every tribe and language and people and nation in Senegal and in Aberdeen. And you have made them through your blood, Jesus, a kingdom and priests to our God, and they shall reign on the earth. Verse 12, worthy is the Lamb who was slain to receive power and wealth and wisdom and honor and so on and so on. It goes on in heaven. Yes, this violence is disgusting. Yes, it is shocking this morning, but it's not an add-on. It's not an add-on. It's not some unfortunate consequence of how Jesus lived or what he said. It is at the very center of Jesus' work. It is at the very center of who Jesus understood himself to be. And it is indeed, friend, at the very center of how Jesus will welcome you this morning. This violence, disgusting as it is so crucial. Those blows that Jesus took were, to a large extent, done by us and done for us. And I'm closing with some words from Isaiah 53. The prophet, speaking of Jesus hundreds of years before he came, said this: "He has borne our griefs. He's carried our sorrows. He was wounded for our transgressions, our wrongdoings, our sins. He was crushed for our iniquities." So yes, we should feel a sense of outrage this morning as we consider this violence toward Jesus Christ, the King of Kings.
Outrage, yes. But also we should feel a sense of ownership. Our grief, our sorrow, our wrongdoing, our sinfulness. That's what those blows were as Jesus was blindfolded and they struck him time and time again. When we truly feel like, when we truly acknowledge that and understand that, it brings us to our knees in worship, thankfulness and adoration. Perhaps this morning again, afresh, or indeed perhaps for the first time. And we come sorrowful for our sin, devastated by the cost of what Jesus took upon himself because of us, but also full of gratitude that in that violence that Jesus suffered and would suffer, in him willingly suffering this ultimate evil, infinitely wrong injustice, he was taking upon himself the punishment which should have been ours. Eugene Peterson's paraphrase of that passage in Isaiah 53 says this: "The fact is, it was our pains he carried, our disfigurements, all the things wrong with us. We thought he brought it on himself, that God was punishing him for his own failures, but it was our sins that did that to him, that ripped and tore and crushed him. Our sins." But then it goes on, "He took the punishment, and that made us whole. Through his bruises, we get healed." Yes, violence is shocking. But there's nothing more shocking than the fact that through the violence that Jesus endured, we can know God's healing this morning. We can know wholeness and hope. That's gloriously shocking. That's worthy of a lifetime of worship. Jesus, help us see the scale and the disgusting reality of our sin and the way that because of our sin you had to endure such disgusting and heinous and horrific injustice. Help us feel that now. And help us feel the wonder that in that beating that you took, in your broken body, in your shedding of blood, you were making a way for us to come to the Father in heaven. You were making a way for us to come and be cleansed of all our wrongdoing. You were taking upon yourself the punishment that we deserve. You were shedding your blood that cleanses us from all unrighteousness. You are being broken so that we can be whole. I pray, God, more and more would you help us to come and embrace your healing, your hope that you have for us this morning and forevermore.